Hello and welcome to Quietly Fascinated. I'm your host, Freya Last. I'm a writer, podcaster, believer in all people starting creative businesses. And this is a podcast for the creative soul as I follow my own journey into entrepreneurship with creativity. Each month, I interview someone who's expansive for me and hopefully expansive for you. It's usually somebody who is creative, who has followed that path and made it a success, and more importantly, is living their most abundant life, their dream life. They have combined their business acumen with their creativity, and they get to live the life that they want. And I ask them how they did it and what journey they took. I imagine if you're listening, you're like me and you're also on this journey. So I hope to be asking the questions that come up in your mind about how people did it, why they did it, how they managed to do it, how they found the money to do it, and what became of it. And I ask all these questions sitting in my Brooklyn kitchen. So let's jump into the next episode. On this month's podcast, we have a special guest. Her name's Dani Raffield. And I came across Dani when I was scrolling through Instagram and I saw her dreamy house atop a cliff in Cornwall that she's renovating, which resonated with me wholly because my dream is to live by the sea one day and renovate an old mansion. However, as we dig in, I discovered she's a creative of her own making and has built her business doing that. And also alongside has a lot of building projects I want to talk about. So welcome to the podcast, Dani.
Thanks, Freya. It's lovely to be there.
Let's talk about the house first of all. Where is it exactly in Cornwall?
So we are in a beautiful harbour village called Flushing, which is in the southwest of Cornwall. In fact, I think there might be a Flushing over near you on that side of the water. I think you've got one in Queens there as well.
As
we do,
that's right.
We do share these kind of coastal paths, don't we, between the US
I think Flushing, Queens is not quite as glamorous as...
Oh, really?
It's sort of where the airport is and a lot of malls. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's about... Well, I think the link is that I think it's Dutch engineers were used to build the harbour walls here. And I think it was a very similar story over there. They went over there and also created kind of harbour works. And that's how we end up with these very similar places, either people travelling from one to the other or people doing work.
So That's interesting.
It's fun, isn't it? We do. Yeah. We have a lot of these fun kind of connections with the US down in Cornwall. I think the Mayflower left from Plymouth, which isn't that much further up, of course, which sails across the water to you guys. So
yeah,
we do have quite a lot of links between the Southwest and the US. So it's been really interesting kind of speaking to people over on your side of the water as well and getting to know people in their areas over there and realising how much we share in common.
We're not that far apart. I'm probably about 45 minutes from Flushing, Queens, which is surrounded by water. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in Brooklyn right now. Yes.
So I'm basically in the quite far southwest of Cornwall. It's a harbour village that's opposite a larger town called Falmouth. And Falmouth is a kind of working, it has been since the very early, probably 13th century working docks. It started as, I kind of think, the packet quays. So it was kind of where they brought news in and out and fishing, all these things. But over the years has developed. It has an arts community, has an engineering and mining community there now with the university, and also a huge amount of tourism. So it's a beautiful, pretty setting. We've got lots of lush green creeks. We've got an area called the Carrick Roads, which is just waterways, dipping and diving in between trees and valleys. It's very beautiful down here. Very lucky.
Sounds amazing. And you have lived there for a while. Tell me how you came across the house that you bought, Raffield House.
So the house, I first noticed it when I moved down here to start studying at the art college that's in Falmouth. And as you go through this little town, we have these small oak ways, which are old passageways that fishermen used to walk in and out of. And as you peer through them, you can see to the other side of the water. And you can't miss this beautiful row of houses off the edge of this tiny fishing village. And they're so interesting and architecturally unique. There's turrets and there's kind of castellets and beautiful features. You just wonder about who would live in places like this. And you sail past it when you take the ferry in and out of Falmouth Docks, or often walk past these houses on the other side of the water. And this one house has never quite fitted with the others. As the others over the years have been worked on, maintained or developed, this one house has just gradually become more and more and more derelict. And I'd looked at it for years and years and thought, gosh, if only I could get my hands on this house, it would be a dream. But I didn't really think that it would ever be possible, because they very rarely come up. I think there's maybe only 8 houses on that bit of road. It's very, very rare that you see one coming up sale. And then if you do, they're usually pretty unattainable. So I just, for years and years, looked from a distance, walked past it, wondered, watched the ivy growing up the sides and the trees covering the windows, you know. It's, yes, it was a house I'd lusted after for a very long time.
And then it came up for sale. How did you stumble across this?
Well, it's an interesting story, actually. So although this house hadn't come up, other houses on that road did start coming up. I think in the kind of COVID era where house values suddenly were going up very quickly, people were making the choice to sell their properties there. And actually, 3 other properties came up for sale there, and I'd already realised it was an incredibly unique place to be, because where we are in the south coast of Cornwall, you don't really get south-facing water properties. So it was so unique to have a place where you had a beach very nearby, you've got a village, you've got the countryside behind you. I'd always said, if something comes up, I'd take anything over there.
It's the dream. It is. The look of the house, the harbour. I mean, I think Cornwall is in a lot of people's dreams.
Yeah,
a lot of people.
It really is.
And those old sort of mansions, Enid Blyton style mansions.
And there's a few of them as well. And they started coming up, and my partner and I said, oh, let's go and have a look. And we went to have a look at one property, and it just was so expensive, there was no way. And we looked at another, and then the pricing on that came back, and it was just eye-watering. And I said to him, look, this is the house, this is the one that I would really love to get. You want this one, this absolute derelict wreck on this beautiful road. And he said, well, let's try and find out who lives there. So we did. We traced the owners. First, we wrote to them, and we didn't hear anything back. And then we tried calling them, and they didn't want to be contacted, basically. So it was a complete dead end. So we gave up on living there. And then I think about, must be nearly a year later, maybe not quite that much, we were away on holiday, and an email dropped into our inbox from one of the agents who'd shown us one of the other properties on the road, and said, we think we've got something you might be interested in. It's this property. And of course, once we saw the property, we went, no.
Wow.
It's her. It's this
property. Yeah.
So we were literally, I mean, you never want your holiday to end. This is the only time we've actually been desperate to get our holiday done and dusted, get back to the UK and go for a viewing. So it's all just luck, I think, how it happened. If we hadn't have gone to see the other properties, they wouldn't have had our details. It all came about that way. So we did go to view it when we got back, and they were opening it up for offers prior to auction. And we made an offer which was accepted, but it's not quite that straightforward, because there are all sorts of isms with Cornish properties. You'll have to stop me if I'm oversharing.
Tell me. I'm not aware of them.
So we have this thing down here called Mundick, which is part of our mining heritage. So Cornwall is a mining county. We have very, very ore-rich ground. And historically, they used mining waste as the aggregate in concrete. But what we've got in the aggregate is lots of pyrite, which is a really sulfide-rich ore. And they used this in the blocks that they were building houses with. But the problem is the sulfides oxidise and create this thing called sulfuric acid, which attacks the structure of the buildings. So we had to have it tested, and it came back that it was suffering from this Mundick. So any house that has Mundick, you can't fix it. It has to be completely removed and rebuilt. So we re-amended our offer and said, look, we're not buying, we're not paying this much when we've got to take so much of it down. And they turned it down and they wouldn't amend the kind of offer. They wouldn't amend the price at all. So at that point, we thought we'd lost it again. Then it went to auction.
Did you just do the live auction and get it?
Yes, so
it went lower than the original offer?
Yes, it did. Yeah. It did. Only, I mean, just about. I think by the time we paid the fees, it was still just slightly shy of where we'd offered, but it was less. The difference with the auction buying process, and I don't know if you have the same over there, is that when you buy at auction here, it's instant. So you have to have everything in place, all of the funds instantly. There is not the conveyancing process to go through. So basically all the legal processes are very fast when you buy at auction.
Right.
So we were scrambling for a month to try and figure out how we could buy this house at auction before selling our other properties. So we had a very nail-biting month of trying to put bridging finance in place. And we registered for the auction, but we only got the go-ahead to bid after the auction had started on other properties. So we didn't even know if we could bid for it. And I think it was about an hour before our lot came up that we got the email that said, you've been approved. And it was just like, oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
So then we joined the auction. Being complete novices, we'd never done a property auction. We'd done a bit of Googling about how you meant to act at an auction, what are you meant to do, and it seemed to work. Basically, the bids kind of started off quite quick and then slowed down, and we thought, wow, it's still in our budget, so we'll jump in, and it happened. We got it. It was
A nail biter.
Yeah, it was a surprise, but what an incredible surprise. We kind of, before we'd even got her, we'd been through this crazy roller coaster with her. It's like she was just kind of prepping us for actually owning her.
So that was immediate. Then it was yours, mm-hmm. basically, after auction. Yeah. And how quickly did you start work on the house?
It was very, very slow. So basically, alongside the Mundick. So the house has been built in three segments. It was first built in 1906, I believe, by the Trefusis Estate, which is the local estate that owns the lands in our area. And they built the central section in 1906. And then it was extended in, we believe, around 1950. There are very few records. And then it was released and sold to the first owner in 1980, who then put on an extension in the 1990s. So in that central original section, they built the house using concrete. But actually in 1906, people weren't really using concrete to build their houses. It was only just starting to be used again, and it was being used with reinforcements. And what they did with the house is they cast all of the openings, the windows and the structural parts with concrete reinforced with steel, but they used beach sand to do it, and salts in the beach sand had basically corroded all of the steel. So we knew we had to take down this Mundick section, but then we had to figure out how to fix the central section of the house. And through lots of testing, we did something called SI, which is site investigation work, where you have to figure out how you can rebuild and underpin your structure. And as we dug down, every report we got back said, we haven't actually reached any good ground yet. they kept coming back going, we found a metre of clay. The next one came back saying, we found 5 metres of clay. The next one came back, we found 80 metres of clay. And basically, long story short, through working with the engineers, it became unfeasible to repair those walls safely, because there are the hearts around the concrete are made from something called cob, which is basically just stone and earth all mixed together and kind of compacted. So we were then in a situation where we had to take down 2/3 of the house, pile down to the bedrock and rebuild back up. So there ensued a whole planning process.
Were you disappointed? Did it damage the integrity of what you'd bought? Were you disappointed that you had to take it down?
Yeah. Absolutely. There was a lot of tears. There are tears, and there were worries about the financial risk to us, having gone into it believing we only had to rebuild 1/3 of it, suddenly to be faced with having to rebuild 2/3 of it. It was sad. And also something that we found very difficult is that we'd fallen in love with the house the way she was. We didn't really want to change her.
Yeah, I understand that.
It was, very sad, very challenging time.
And budget-wise, how incremental was the, how big was the increase?
This is interesting. Sorry, no. This is where it is a really interesting question, because we did get costings for that 1/3 rebuild, 1/3 renovation, and then the other 1/3 was in much better condition. And actually, like for like, it's almost the same. It's basically so cost effective to build from new and so expensive to renovate the existing. Because when you renovate old buildings, you've got to deal with the damp, the insulation, and replacing all of the windows. Actually, the costs, like for like, have come out really similar, which we were flabbergasted. So
that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I prefer renovating properties myself. I love historic properties that you can, pour love into, but they are timely, and sometimes they timely, costly, and they don't always end up as good as the new materials that you can put in for a new build. And I'm always dealing with contractors who want to knock things down and build from new because it's so much easier for them.
Yes.
But I had never factored in that almost you can save all that money because of the cost effectiveness of the new materials.
Mm. But it does open up a new challenge, which is that I'm very much like you. I wanted to restore this property. That was my dream, would be kind of re-rendering the lines, restoring the sash windows. And we're not in that situation anymore, which is heartbreaking. But now the challenge is figuring out how to rebuild her and recreate her and put those features back in. And I think one of the kind of saving graces is that actually over the years she'd had a lot of her features stripped out. So most of the fireplaces had gone, all of the coving had gone. She'd been treated pretty badly. So now it's a case of trying to research how we can rebuild her in the right way, with the right feeling.
Excuse me. I dropped
That's
the mic.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of research into what makes a house feel that way, and also some questions around, are we doing the right thing, rebuilding her in the right style? But fundamentally, that's what we wanted, is the house that we saw. So we've committed to rebuilding her the way she was before, as we take her down, the way she was at the beginning. So it's a really weird situation to be in, building a new build. Building a heritage new build, it's very strange.
Yeah. So have you, I know following the Instagram stories, you found some surprises along the way. There was a dip in the roof at some point. Is that correct? What transpired from that?
So I think the biggest shock we had actually, the roof strangely was mostly okay. I think it was subsidence you might be referring to. We found one of the big bays was actually physically sinking and leaning out towards the sea. Yes, that we suspected that might be happening, so we were semi-prepared for that. Probably the biggest surprise we had was losing part of the cliff face, the front of the garden, in a storm. It shook everything off, and suddenly we'd had surveys done on it, and they'd said, you know, at some point it would be good to install some stabilisation, but for now you should be okay. But it wasn't. So we got a phone call from one of the neighbours saying, we've just heard an incredible amount of noise coming from your house. I think you've had a landslide. So we went over and we had basically lost quite a lot of the front of the cliff. So that became our first massive distraction and challenge, was refixing the seawall for a start, which was in very pitiful state. And then we had to get this very complicated system put in where they inject concrete into the slope surface to anchor in pins and then smother the surface of the slope in a blanket that plants can grow through, and that basically holds it all back. But we've done it. We've got a 100-year warranty on it now. So.
Oh, that's so interesting, because my other question was, how are you going to protect it on that seafront? I mean, the dreamiest of dreamy locations, but precarious. And you often see pictures of houses sliding into the sea. How do you, and there's a 100-year guarantee on the work that was done, that house will stay there for 100 years. Because it is right at the tippy top of a cliff face, correct?
It really is. It really is. I mean, we're quite lucky, although maybe it's the power of social media, it seems quite dramatic. The sea doesn't very often touch the wall at the bottom of the cliff. So there is a bit of garden down near sea level. And then we do have, I believe our sea wall is, I think it's about 2.4 metres high, as are our neighbours' walls, sea walls as well. So actually now it's fixed and corrected. It's been a huge engineering task to do it. And there aren't many engineers who specialise in sea walls. It was quite unique.
So, although I imagine a lot of them are based down in Cornwall.
Actually it was a local firm in the end. We spoke to some quite big companies, but it was a local firm who were able to come up with a solution. So hopefully, they've designed it expecting the sea to rise, so they have calculated everything on sea rise levels over the next 100 years, where are we going to be, and they've designed it in a similar way to the original walls from the village harbour. So the way the harbour town was built was off this this system where they use stacked stones that actually breathe the water. So they don't stop the water, they kind of absorb it and allow it to pass through. So the wall down at the bottom has actually been designed in a similar way. Although it will stop most of the force of the water, it's designed to allow the water to move through so that the forces are minimised on it. So yeah, again, sorry, I get very boring with the technical stuff. I get very excited.
It's fascinating how you can restore these houses and how no one thought about it 100 years ago. And now there's all this technology as the climate changes, to adapt. Which,
well, I think you can either with historic houses, you can either be very, very lucky in that where they weren't able to calculate things as precisely, they either wildly over-engineered things, which is why you get these incredible old castles still standing thousands of years later. And you think, how did they design this? But they couldn't design it, so they over-designed it. Or you kind of end up with our situation, which is they didn't quite get it right, and it's crumbling. So.
And the Mundig didn't last, yeah.
Yeah.
So this isn't your first design. In fact, you've been on Grand Designs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think it's interesting how you work up to these dream properties or how you take the risks. This one's a big leap for, I feel, a regular person who's maybe got a house on a street who fancies moving to the countryside. It's a huge renovation project, but you've taken on other projects before, smaller projects, and built up to this one. So I know you built the house you built on Grand Designs, it was from the ground up. Can you tell us a little bit about that one? Where it was, what sort of building it was, what materials you used?
So I must have a little bit of a thing for buying houses that are ex-estate houses, because it was also an estate house. It was, we found basically, we have a woodworking business and we'd always dreamed of having a kind of home where we could have the workshop in Woodland. It was this fantasy which we hadn't really thought could happen, but this very small gamekeeper's lodge, which was 40 square metres in total, with no bathroom, no hot water, no telephone or internet, no facilities, came up that it had 5 acres of woodland.
Wow.
And we went to go and see it. It was very cheap because it was unmortgageable. So in the UK, obviously, if a house doesn't have an indoor bathroom or a kitchen, you can't borrow money against it.
So it was literally a gamekeeper's lodge.
Yeah.
So it was just for them to sort of stay the night, keep their things. For Americans, 40 square meters is about 4,000 square foot.
Yeah. So it was tiny. It was actually...
400 square foot. Sorry. 400 square foot.
Yes. it was... So it's where the estate's gamekeeper lived and bred the pheasants and any game that they used for shooting. So there are a couple of barns behind the cottage where you can see all the little kind of pigeon holes where they would have bred all of the fowl that they would have released for shooting season. So it just would have been one man and his animals living in this very tiny cottage. It was not designed for a family, but we went for it anyway. We just had our first child and he was a baby, and I thought, I can't raise a baby in this. And then I thought, I can. As soon as I saw the woodland, I thought, we can. So we moved into it.
So without a bathroom, you moved into
bathroom.
It?
Or
did you have a... Did you?
Nope.
Did you have a...
There was...
What did you have? Porta potty, they call it here, Portaloo?
There was a toilet and a hot water tank in one of the barns with a bath attached to it. And we used it just the same as the gamekeeper would have used it back in the day.
Blimey, so, or... Yeah.
We used to go outside... Day, night, all the time, walk across to the barn to be able to go to the bathroom. It was beautiful, actually, because you'd go out in the night and you'd have all the owls and the bats flying overhead. You know, it's very connected with nature. It was a real experience. And we actually lived with it like that, I think, for nearly 2 years, until we got to a place where we were like, right, we have to build something now or extend it. Because we'd focused on developing the business and building the workshops for the business first, because obviously that took priority. So we went through the planning process, and what we wanted to build was a house made from the wood that we'd collected from windfall around our own woodland. So over the years, we'd collected many, many trees. As they'd come down, we'd kind of had them milled, stacked them, and we really wanted the house to have this architectural timeline from the estate, who had built it in the estate style, which was quite unique. And then we'd taken it on as custodians. It was a listed building, which means it's kind of heritage protected. We felt it was very important that whatever we put on didn't try to just mix in and kind of fake its history. We felt it had to be very readable, that it had been in the hands of the estate and we'd taken it, and then it had been built in the style of us as the kind of occupiers. So we built it went from 40 square metres, but you know, I can't remember the exact size at the end. I'll have to look it up for you. But I think we did end up at about 40,000 square feet, I think. I'll have to double check it, maybe slightly more. It was huge, absolutely huge by the end. We were amazingly, the heritage side of planning really supported us in turning it into a proper working family home. So we built a very modern, I don't know how to explain the style of architecture. It's quite unique. It's steam bent, obviously, because that was our trade. It had lots of lovely south-facing glass, but it kind of melded into the landscape of the woodland behind it and was connected, very gently connected to the old cottage at the front of it. So it was a real celebration of materials and historic kind of timelines of building.
How amazing. I must add that Grand Designs is a British show. They do show it on, I think, on Netflix here in America, but it's really a testament to new builds and people who are doing it off their own back. It's not a development company. It's usually a family or a couple who have financed an interesting project. It's sort of a cult series. It's been going for years. But that's incredible. So that project was a natural lead on from what you were already doing in your business when we talk about steam bending the wood. Mm-hmm. We're sort of going... we're going backwards from where we are to through your history of how you ended up there. Tell us a little bit about your business and how you got into it. And then I'd love to talk about your creative journey, because I think the whole timeline shows how you get to a house like the water's edge, and how you've used your creativity to be able to get there. So tell me a little bit about what you do for a living and your business and how you got there.
Okay. So I have an incredible business which I own with my now ex-husband. We have since separated, since building the house. It's apparently, it is a grand designs thing as well. There's a kind of a lotto of get pregnant, run out of money, get a divorce. All of these things do happen in real life.
It really is. I think they do a flashback of like where people are, and they're always divorced after they built the house.
Almost always. You can't plan for these things. Maybe I should have seen it coming. But even though we've separated, we do share this business together. So we both studied at the same university. And although we didn't really know each other when we were there, we met when my ex was revisiting the area, started dating. And he had at the time a business with three other students that he studied with, or two other students, sorry, there's three of them in total. And while we were dating, that business folded, basically, and he found himself without anything to do and was at this kind of junction. And that really is where this journey began, taking those skills, because I was not a woodworker. He was very much the woodworker. These are his skills and his speciality. You know, he developed this technique with steam bending. And we both kind of, I guess, brought something to the table with design and product design. And we started making furniture and lighting using a process called steam bending, which I'm sure some people will know. Some people might not know. It's a very historic technique they used to use for boat making, actually.
Oh, wow. So
that's the origins of kind of steam bending wood. With people would use it to bend the wood around boats' hulls and create the shapes that you need for that. And basically we use the same process to create pieces of furniture and lighting. And the business over the years has gone through many transitions from just being the two of us to now being a wonderful team of people down here in Cornwall who make and care and look after and distribute everything from the business. So yeah, it's a very creative business, but also now a very professional one, I guess.
So you studied engineering at university, college?
Well, kind of. I started in engineering the first time I went to university. So as a child, I'd done very well at the mathematics and the sciences side of schooling and done absolutely dreadfully at all the English and useful subjects that people can actually do something with.
That's questionable, by the way, because I did all the English. I've never found anything to do with it.
Okay. I think English is a very beautiful skill. Very beautiful.
It's very, very nice to study. But you also attribute that to you have dyslexia. You're diagnosed with dyslexia, correct?
Mm. Yes, yeah. I think that a lot of, and I don't think it's all dyslexics, but I think there are a lot of us who find that mathematics is our language, that sciences make sense, that things where everything's based on fact and process and system are just very natural, whereas kind of the processing of letters and words and language is much more challenging. Mm-hmm. I think you'll find there's an awful lot of engineers and designers who are dyslexic. You find obviously a lot of entrepreneurs who are on the spectrum as well. I mean, autism, ADHD, these things all go hand in hand, I think, with creativity or entrepreneurship.
Yes. Yeah.
I think we're starting to learn more about it now, I think, aren't we?
We are, yeah. I mean, it's a very hot topic in the news and people contest it and people are looking into it. I don't think we finalised on broadening out education to match everybody's skill set as yet and accommodate everybody. But I find it so amazing that some people, some creatives are able to find their path and others flounder or struggle a little bit more. But you told me an amazing story about your grandmother.
Yes.
Would it be okay to share that?
Absolutely. No, I was definitely a flounderer and didn't know. I'd always loved creativity and been making and doing and fixing things or taking things apart or decorating or building since a child, and had tried several times to choose a pathway to study creative arts, basically. And every time I tried, generally the advice is that you should invest in more useful subjects to carry on with the mathematics, carry on with the sciences. And when I went to university to study engineering, I didn't really want to do it. I really wanted to go and do something much more creative, but I didn't know what. And my family felt I should very much just go and experience being a student at university. It didn't matter if I passed or failed or what happened. They said, just go and enjoy it. You'll love being a student. So I did. I went and studied engineering, and it was a fantastic course. It's very interesting. You know, it's a wildly educational, very, very male-oriented course. I think at one point, I think I mentioned to you, I was one of three girls amongst 75 boys.
Wow.
It's a fantastic course, but I wasn't enjoying it. I just found it very, very boring. It wasn't really challenging me in the right ways. And I was pretty miserable. And I happened to call my grandmother, who had long said I shouldn't be doing it, even before I'd gone. She was like, why aren't you doing something creative? She was the one person who had said, do something creative. Anyhow, I had a very sad moment where I'd left a lecture and just felt completely exhausted and just desolate, thinking, what am I doing in my life? Am I going to do this for the rest of my life and not like it?
Yeah.
And she picked up the phone and she said, how are you? And I think I probably cried for about the first 5 minutes. And once she calmed me down and said, you know, tell me what's going on. I just said, I'm not enjoying it. And her words, after a slightly dramatic pause, she just said, quit. She said, walk over there and tell them you don't want to do this anymore. Thank them and say, it's not right for me. Don't do it anymore. And I kind of said, I can't. I've already paid for the year. You know, I'm here. I've got the house. You know, everything's set up. I'm on this pathway. She's like, no, just do it. If you don't do it now, you're not going to do it. And she said, I will speak to the family. I'll speak to your father. She said, don't you worry about that side of things. I just need you to go and talk to the people at the university and tell them you don't want to do it anymore. And I did exactly what she told me.
That was great.
Yeah, I took myself out of engineering. I got home again. I thought, what am I going to do? First things first, luckily there was this university. There was also an art college opposite it. So I went from the university, walked over to the art college and said, what can I do? I really want to get into the arts. And they said, well, have you done anything in your educational past? Have you got a GCSE or an A-level? And I was like, no, nothing. And they said, well, perhaps you could do a night class. So I signed up for the night class. I got myself a job. I started temping and working around different businesses to earn money while I put myself back through school again. And I think I completed 3 years in total at that art college, until I'd got back up to an educational level where I could go back to university this time. I went to study design. So yeah, it was a real journey, and it was all because of that one matriarch, that one strong, you know, and confident woman who pushed me to make a change where I wouldn't have without her. Yeah, that was a sliding doors moment, I think.
I know. I think a lot of kids, well, I call them kids because I'm so old, but young people struggle with that exact decision of being told that the creativity doesn't accomplish a salary that they would desire. Mm-hmm. So they don't often follow their purpose. But you can be very creative with following what you're good at. And you're a great example of that, building a business. I would love to know how the Water's Edge is today and what are the current challenges and what is the timeline for the house?
So as of today, we have completed, so we've removed those parts that needed to be removed. We're recycling some of the materials to go back underneath the building. We've put in, I don't know if this translates to the kind of technical structure over there, we've put piles in, which is these giant, basically concrete and steel posts down through the ground into the bedrock.
Okay.
And we're just starting to cast the foundations on top of those piles now, ready to start rebuilding those segments of walls. So we are, it feels like we've been going for absolutely ages, but we're at the beginning, I guess, of the rebuild. I'm calling it the rebuildovation because it's this weird space between it's a new build, it's a renovation, it's neither one or the other. We think our goal is to be in by March of 2026. So we've got a lovely Gantt chart all drawn out of all the timelines. That's the goal, is to be in before next summer.
Okay.
So we get to enjoy our first summer there, basically, after we move in.
How wonderful. Oh, that's
good. We all know, though, don't we? I'm sure you're very aware that timelines are a slightly elastic concept when it comes to construction work.
I remember one house we just moved back in. It was just taking so long and we just had to get in for summer, so we just moved in and our contractor, they're called here, our contractor was very huffy about it, but we just sort of worked with them, and I think it did speed the process up because he really didn't want us there. He just wanted out of that property. Very perfection orientated, so he didn't want people, you know, the kids and our life and all the food all over the kitchen. So it actually worked in our favor. He just sped up, got out of there.
That's great.
He was
a strategy.
We wouldn't use him again, just FYI.
No names.
It was pretty tense by the end of it, but it got us the house. But that sounds wonderful. Well, I would love to hear any updates, and you're going to have to let us know how it goes.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm on this journey of sharing all on the internet at the moment. So I think we're going to stick with it. It's been like therapy, I think, online therapy, sharing the process.
It's so exciting because it's such a beautiful backdrop to see what's happening with it. So you started sharing about the house and you've had a few conversations and interest. Obviously, I'm in New York, and so you'd never imagine it to go that far afield, I guess. What other interest has it drawn?
It's absolutely been bonkers. I have been having conversations with people in places that are some I'd never heard of, some I'd heard of, but I could only dream that I would ever get to interact with anybody from there. Obviously, on your side of the water, all over the US and Canada.
So where are some of the places?
Oh, I mean, I think some of the most extraordinary ones. I've had people contacting me from New Zealand, and Tasmania, from Vietnam.
Wow.
Just
interested in the project, or they want to come and visit it.
Argentina. I mean, it's these are people I would never meet in my normal life. I'd never have these conversations with. But how extraordinary that bricks and mortar can connect us. Obviously, it's universal.
And I think the backdrop is uniquely British, as in it looks like a scene from a storybook. So I think it's tinkling with everybody's historic minds. You know, I can imagine the Downton Abbey worldwide going to a historic vacation home such as that in the 1900s. So I can see why it's really sparked a lot of inspiration for people.
Okay.
But I do think it takes a creative soul to take on a project like that. Creative in terms of finances and how you can cope mm-hmm. with things and how you can roll with the punches and the changes and then create something new and historic at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think being creative, I think you're able to take risks because you trust yourself. You trust that if something goes wrong, you'll find a way to think around it, or you're inquisitive enough to not just... There have been times when we haven't just accepted things are a certain way. We've, you know, really researched what can we do? How can we do this? There must be another way of fixing a seawall or, you know, all of these things. And we actually, a lot of the team we have around us are very creative as well and have been absolutely fantastic kind of out-of-the-box thinkers. And I'd say, yes, anyone who's creative, take on a project. Take on a project. You will find that you are capable and able to turn your skills in multiple directions. You know, I think there's a real link between creativity and being... I don't think entrepreneurial is quite the right word. Being able to find successes in different parts of life, in different skills and in different kind of disciplines. So yes, I think I'm probably sending lots of people off now to doom scroll on. I don't know what the equivalent of right move is over there.
Truly,
I think. Zillow? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Nothing quite as good as right move, I have to say. But I also think these like poignant points in your life where you have taken risks to follow your creative pings have really helped, starting from that really great bit of advice from your grandmother.
Yes, she's right. You just got to be happy.
She was wise and she knew.
Yeah, it's always, you know, that is the thing. I think we all focus so much on the value of our careers. And it, you know, it's right. We do all need to live and we need to make enough money to have a comfortable life. But happiness is just so valuable. I mean, I just think if you can really, really find what brings you joy, then you'll find success. It will just come and find you. It's that weird manifestation, I think, where if you believe it, it will happen. I do think that's possible.
Was happiness the motivation for getting the house?
Oh, totally. I think that I found myself, you know, I built the dream once already. The last house that we did in the woodland was meant to be the end game, kind of building the dream. And I found myself in a situation where it wasn't and had to go through a process of rebuilding and pivoting my life somewhat. And just as I was kind of happy and doing life on my own, I met this wonderful partner who wanted to share life with me. And I think we saw, both of us had this dream of being by the water. And it's that kind of pipe dream. You all talk about the things that, what if? Yeah. What if I won the lottery? You know, what would you do? And we'd shared that. And I think when the opportunity came up to actually make it happen, it was like, this can be our forever. This can be the home that the children grow up in, that older children come back to visit, grandchildren. I so want to be. I really visualise being a grandma in that house, having a huge Christmas tree, you know.
Yeah. All of egg hunt for the grandchildren.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I know you're not meant to wish to be old, but I genuinely can't wait to be old there. I think it's all about... I think for me, it's very much like that grandmother that gave me that advice. She created a home that people were drawn to, always. People gathering for birthdays or parties or, you know, just people popping by. The door was always open, close, as people would come and go. And I think actually I'm probably looking back to her again in that I want that. I want to create that home that people can just come to and be happy at. So, yeah, it's all about the happiness for sure.
Oh, I would definitely come back season after season if I had a grandmother there. It's very dreamy. Just to round off, it does sound like a gorgeous area filled with water. And I've been to Cornwall. There's a lot of surfing as well, which is one of my passions. If anyone's visiting Cornwall, and that specific area, do you have any recommendations? I often find that people who are creative find these hidden nooks and hidden treasures that like nurture people, and I really enjoy recommendations from them. So let me know what you think. Ooh. Food or just things to do or just a place is fine.
We are so wealthy when it comes to beautiful places and spaces in Cornwall. And it is such an immensely varied, we're very peninsular, so the differences between the north coast, the south coast or the west coast are huge. So I could probably spend a week recommending places. My biggest recommendation though would be get out on foot. We have this incredible thing, which I don't think every county in every country has, that we have access to our coastline. You can walk every single part of the coastline here freely and pass all of the land. And it's so incredible because you see spaces that you don't see from the road or even probably by boat. You know, I would say my biggest recommendation to anybody visiting Cornwall is get out on that coastal path, get walking, go and have a look around the rock pools and the coves. And you will always find good food and good people on the way. You just can't help but fall over the good stuff when you're doing that.
What a great recommendation. Thank you so much, Danny.
No, thank you. It's been a real joy talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening to Quietly Fascinated. If you have an idea of someone you would like me to interview, or you have an idea of questions that you'd rather me ask, or any feedback at all, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to know who's listening. You can reach out to me on all the social platforms at Quietly Fascinated Podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being here.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.